Thank you again to all of you who are here this morning. This is a very large group and I'm very excited about it. My name is Allison Gray and I teach at St. Mary's University in San Antonio. I'm a professor of New Testament and early Christian literature. So what I am doing this week with the Living Word is a study of how some New Testament metaphors get used to build community and to create a sense of kinship and belonging. I've said this at the beginning of most sessions. I am teaching an undergraduate course on this in the fall. I'm trying to work on a book project sort of on this topic about how these metaphors are useful and also maybe damaging to community life. And so one of the things that I am very interested in hearing from you are the associations that you bring to these metaphors. So the plan of each session is to share a little bit about what these metaphors would have meant or what weight they would have carried for people in the first century world who were reading the texts as they were being written, right? If we think about especially Paul's original audience, the people he was writing letters to, if he said, "You are a soldier of Christ," or "I am a soldier of Christ," how would they have heard that? What did soldier mean to them? What cultural associations would they have brought? So we're going to talk about the social reality for soldiers in the first century. And think about how Paul used those metaphors to create a sense of belonging. Why were they useful in his time? But the text does not stop meaning things after the first century, right? And what Paul intended may not be what we hear today. So we as readers matter because we bring our own meaning to the text. So the second piece is to examine our own context and think about what we mean, what we hear when we think about soldiers today. So when we read the text that says, "You are a soldier of Christ," how does that resonate with us? What does it bring up? What kinds of things are we not thinking about that Paul might have been thinking about? And then our final question that we'll end with, that I'm very interested in hearing your answers to, is in what ways does this metaphor of fellow soldiers or soldiers of Christ create belonging today? Who might it exclude? Who might it include that it did not include in the first century? And in what ways is it perilous for us to use? In what ways does it hold promise for church today? So that's where we're going. And as always, I'd like to start with a text. So let's jump in with 1 Thessalonians. This is a very famous passage that does not actually mention the word soldiers, but certainly has some of the trappings of soldiers, quite literally. So Paul says to the Thessalonian community, "So then let us not fall asleep as others do, but let us keep awake and be sober. For those who sleep, sleep at night, and those who are drunk, get drunk at night. But since we belong to the day, let us be sober and put on the breastplate of faith and love, and for a helmet, the hope of salvation. For God has destined us not for wrath, but for obtaining salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for us, so that whether we are awake or asleep, we may live with him." Now, there's a lot going on in this passage. He's using the language of awake and asleep because in the Thessalonian community, one of the problems that he's facing is he said Jesus is coming back right away. And then the Thessalonians had some members of their community die. And they said, "Well, what happens to those people? We thought Jesus was going to come and raise us all. So what about the ones who have fallen asleep?" So awake and asleep in some ways here is about alive and dead. So that image is part of what's going on. He is also clearly using armor as a metaphor for preparation for salvation, right? But I think it's worth talking about when we read this passage and you think of yourselves as members of this Christian community being advised to put on the breastplate and the helmet. What are the expectations of you as a soldier? What does it mean to be a soldier in this community?
I think he's speaking of protection. The breastplate and the helmet are means of protecting yourself.
Against evil.
Against a lack of faith and love. Against the lack of hope in salvation, even though people are already
Right, so there's a very real question that he's responding to. So there's protection against loss of hope, I think, for Paul in this Thessalonian community. The people might lose hope that Jesus is coming back. They might lose hope that salvation is real. So the armor is a way of protecting yourself against that. Now, you raised the idea that it might be protection against evil. Are there other things in this passage that add to that impression that it's protecting against evil or outside forces?
Well,
Destined not for wrath.
Good.
I think that the breastplate is covering the heart.
Yes.
An important part in the helmet is covering our head and our eyes and our mind and shoulders.
Good. So if we think about how the parts of the body are associated with different qualities, our rational mind, our emotional self, this is armor for those essential parts of the human person. Okay. Yes.
Could staying awake be the people who were on the night watch protecting the community?
On guard.
Yes. Say a little bit more about what you mean by protecting the community.
Well, standing at the door at night to keep intruders out so others can sleep safely. That kind of watch.
Okay. So there are some who are appointed to be on guard for others. Right?
And let us be sober. Mm-hmm. Go back to let us remain cognitive, within our wits, and thoughtful and planful.
Yes. So I would say that's picking up on one aspect of what it means to be a soldier is to be alert, right? To guard others, to guard yourself, but to use your mind, right? Because one of the important qualities of soldiers is to be strategic. The Greek word for a general is a strategos, which is our word strategy, right? So that is a quality that soldiers are meant to have. Other ideas? I think I saw a hand over here earlier.
Well, I was saying that to put on the breastplate and the helmet is also to prepare.
Yes.
You're not just taking protection, but you're getting ready to go out into battle, so you're preparing.
Yes, right? There is forethought. Happening here. There is a plan, not just a reaction to something that might happen.
And if they're concerned because people are dying, he's actually maybe saying, we have to prepare for the long haul.
Yes, right? What are we preparing for? Not just the immediate circumstance, but living in this community going forward. It's not necessarily going to be forever because Jesus is still coming back soon, but we need to be ready for the intervening time. I saw a hand in the back.
Yeah, I was going to say, putting on breastplate and helmet's not that hard, but breastplate at that time took a while to put on. And so to continually have it on and be ready for anything at a moment's notice.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So maybe the idea of steadfastness, right? Mm-hmm. That same idea that we have with athletes, that you are enduring or holding out.
And then I think at the end, just the assurance that whether we're awake or asleep, regardless of our situation, kind of reassuring the Thessalonians that we may live with Christ.
Mm-hmm. So there is, again, a sort of a goal, right? There is faith and love and hope for salvation or hope of salvation. There is something that lies ahead that we are looking towards. Yes, please, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I'm connecting the night and the day with light and darkness.
Yes.
And so the verse 8 going into verse 9, but since we belong to the day, so we belong to the light, we belong to Jesus, can be sober. And so because we can do that, or because we have all these things, Even though we have all these things, God has taken care of it for us. Like there's this assurance that Jesus has taken care of it. So whether we're living in darkness or whether we're living in light, like Jesus has taken care of it for us, that we can live in that faith and salvation. Like there's no wonder anymore. There's no need to be fearful. Or
I think that picks up nicely on the word God has destined us, right? There is this sense that something is coming that God is in charge of, not human beings. So this raises two questions for me. Who's in charge, right? If you're a soldier, presumably there's someone who is commanding you. So based on Paul's usage, who's in charge? And then because you picked up on this light and dark, day and night language, are there sides? Right? And I saw your hand.
Well, I want to know the meaning of destined.
Yeah.
God has destined, which means there's a plan for us to go a particular place. But it's not the same word as delivered. So
it is not, yeah.
You know, it hasn't happened. And is that, can you talk about that word?
Oh, interesting. Okay, so this translation, destined, eteto, this translation gives a point, and it's our word thesis, so it's sort of like to set something out. So God has set us in the sense of destined, having put on this path.
We're on the path.
Yes.
But we're not at the arrival point.
Correct.
So things could still go wrong. God hasn't destined us for the wrath. But we can still screw up, right?
Yeah. Presumably, right? I think for Paul, that's very much a reality. That you have been called to be in this community, but he often advises people don't backpedal, right? This is one thing he says to the Thessalonians. You've been brought from your worship of idols into a new way of life. Don't go back to that, right? So there is a
future. You know, the future we're going to have salvation.
Yes. He's destined us for obtaining salvation through Jesus who died for us, right? That part already happened.
Right.
But we're going to obtain salvation in the future. And this dynamic is there in Philippians, right? There's this idea of work out your salvation. This is something that is ongoing, even though the prerequisite for salvation has already happened through the death and resurrection of Christ. So that Christ has already died. We are working going forward to obtain our salvation so that we may live with him, probably eternal life, right? So there's a lot of time jumping back and forth that we theologically today think about differently than I imagine Paul was. I don't know that he was asking the same questions about how it works and when it happens that we ask today. So when we look at Paul, sometimes we're like, what? But when you say that, that seems to contradict what we know about how salvation works. Like, I'm not sure that Paul had it fully worked out, right? He was working through it in conversation with community.
So it can sound like predestination.
Yeah, and some have read it that way, right? Yes.
So can we go back to the who's in charge?
Yeah, please.
Who else could we presume is in charge besides God?
Are there other possibilities?
Powers and principalities.
So maybe there are worldly or otherworldly forces who could be involved.
Well, in a sense, Paul would understand himself to be in charge because of his message. He brings the gospel. So he has a particular place of leadership, I think.
Good.
He communicates with.
Absolutely, right? Paul as leader who is advising them how to equip themselves for the battle.
Strategizing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Although he does use us, right? Mm. We belong to the day. Let us be sober and put on the breastplate of faith and love. So he's including himself there, which would suggest that the authority is above him, right? So that takes us back to your question, could it be anyone else but God?
Not ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
We sometimes think we're in charge. We are not.
So in some ways, this metaphor is nice because it reminds us of a hierarchical structure in which we fit, where we are not in charge, right? We have a duty.
But yeah.
We are to be prepared. We are to guard and protect each other, but we are not the ones necessarily making the battle plan. We are carrying out the battle plan.
And if we carry out the plan, because when I first read it, mm-hmm. it's like the last 10 contradicts the previous from 6 on, because whether we are awake or asleep, we may live with him. But if you think of it as long as we put on our breastplate and the helmet, then it's okay if we fall asleep.
Okay, so here's where I think the idea of sleep meaning death is working in verse 10, but not in verse 6, right? So verse 6, he's saying, let us not fall asleep as others do by becoming complacent or not paying attention. That, I think, is talking about mental laziness. But when he's getting to verse 10, in the context of the letter as a whole, I think he means whether we are awake, still living, or asleep, having died, we will live eternally with Christ.
Okay.
So when we take this out of context, he's definitely playing with what we mean by sleep, but I think he's got two different uses in the passage.
If we are destined not for wrath,
mm-hmm.
but for obtaining salvation, then in verse 8, is there a hint of renunciation of actual military gear?
When you say, so the way I would take that is if we belong to the day.
We will not put on actual military protective gear. We will put on faith, love, and the hope of salvation.
Right.
And that may come up elsewhere in the session, right?
Mm-hmm. Right? How much does Paul expect that this image of military preparation is metaphorical, and how much does he think it should align with actual reality of joining military forces?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Does he mean that? What would Paul say about engaging in acts of war?
And I'm suggesting that this has the seed of we would not.
Right? I think especially the second half of 8, for a helmet, the hope of salvation. Right? That is the only protection you need, because who cares what happens to your body? Because who cares if you die now? The goal is eternal life. I saw a hand again.
It's interesting that verse 6, when you first started reading it to us, it made me go right to the garden. Jesus
and Gethsemane.
Tells his disciples not to fall asleep. And I thought about, well, could Jesus be the commander or the leader? But that was not the example Jesus set.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jesus set a very servant leader example, and you know, it was not the king that everyone thought he was going to be. So it's interesting that Paul is not. To me, it doesn't seem like Paul is referencing Jesus as the commander of this possible army that we're a part of.
Mm-hmm. Not here, right? Here it does seem to be God in command. Elsewhere, he does identify himself and others as soldiers of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
So we get both, but you're correct that here it does not appear to be Christ. Yes?
I think Jacob had his hand up first.
In other places where he says, you know, let us put on the whole armor of God.
Yes.
He's talking about prayer,
mm-hmm.
and it's not to be taken literally, but he's using the image of the strongest force,
yes.
that they knew at that time, which was the Roman army,
yes.
which had conquered them and enslaved them or dominated them. So I think he's using that, but he's using it metaphorically.
Yes. Right, and I think this one is very nice. It's very clear that he is using it to mean something else. These qualities or virtues that you should cultivate are the things that will protect you.
Right.
That gets us into the ancient context, and I especially love that you brought up the fact that people who are reading this letter in Thessaloniki, a historically Greek city, would experience the Roman army as oppressors, not as protectors.
Right.
Right? So let's talk about soldiers in the ancient world. I have some images to share with you. I love this artifact. It's called the Gemma Augustea. And it is, what are these things called? Where the lighter is on top and you carve down to get to the dark cameo, thank you. They're usually small pieces of jewelry. This thing is about 10 centimeters to a side. But beautifully, intricately carved. And I like that it has two registers, and so I'll say a little bit about the top. We've got Augustus there being crowned with the crown of victory, so think again about that athlete image, what it means to be victorious. The emperor claims that for himself. This is a kind of power that Paul is claiming for himself and the Christians, but it's also something that the emperor claims. We've got his astrological sign of Capricorn, so that we can identify him. The eagle of Jupiter, the highest Roman god, is sitting underneath his chair, so Jupiter's power is sort of holding the emperor up. There are members of his family in a chariot, a military chariot, who are coming along. And then some of these figures, it's the emperor's wife, seated immediately to his right, we see her on the left there, and she has a military helmet on, so she's being portrayed as a victorious military goddess accompanying him. So military might is part of the emperor's self-image. This is a way to display power, right? To associate yourself with soldiers. The other thing that's really interesting to me is that on the bottom register of this, we have actual soldiers preparing for a triumph. And most of you have heard of the triumph, right? This is the military parade after a victory, after they've conquered a new province. The soldiers would bring back the spoils of war and parade them through the city of Rome so that everyone could see what they had gained. So the military was responsible for expanding the borders of the empire and then protecting those borders. And many times, soldiers were sent out into the colonies to settle those colonies in order to claim them as part of the empire. So what we see here is armor being set up on a pole that's going to be paraded through the street. On the far left there, right, this is a foreign soldier's helmet, shield, armor. So it's a symbol of Roman victory, but because it is a symbol of the defeat of their opponents. We also see captors here, both male and female, who are bound and not dressed in armor, right? They're, in fact, the men are very scantily clad. Their bodies, as conquered peoples, are put on display, and they are also paraded through the street to demonstrate Roman military might. These are the people that we have conquered who are now our subjects. So the difference in registers here is, I think, shows very clearly that the authority of the emperor and his family rests upon the work of the soldiers and the military and the oppression of people in the provinces who have been conquered, who are often Greeks, Jews, right? The people who became early Christ believers in the province of Judea had this experience of the Roman Empire. I think this comes home to us very vividly in this famous relief from the Arch of Titus. And the Arch of Titus is in Rome. This is illustrating, the triumph of Titus and his soldiers after they had sacked the temple in Jerusalem, which took place in 70 CE. So this is after the lifetime of Jesus, while the early Christ believers are sort of gathering themselves together to figure out what it means to be a Christ believer. Are we Jews? Are we something else? How do we fit in? While this is going on, the Romans come and destroy the temple in Jerusalem. And you can see a candlestick there, other temple property, much of which was quite beautiful and ornate. And the Roman soldiers are carrying it through the street to show we have conquered in Judea and put down a Jewish rebellion to display our power. So for Jewish Christ believers, the Roman army would have been maybe particularly problematic, right? to put it mildly.
Except that there were soldier Christians. Soldier Jews, I think, or not Jewish soldiers.
That was less common, but there were some both Jews and people who later identified themselves as Christians who were part of the army. Because the army was a way to advance, right? If you were going to get sent out to a province to help settle and protect that province, you might be paid in land. And so all of a sudden, if you were coming from a lower class where you did not own property, you could be given property and then you could have your own land. This was a source of wealth. They were well paid. They were sent to various parts of the empire. We have lots of letters from soldiers from the ancient world who are writing back home. But it's also a way to gain citizenship, which comes with a lot of rights and protections.
They wouldn't necessarily have been converts, would you say?
Converts from
Roman,
from Greco-Roman religions?
To Jewish religion or Christian?
So Judaism and the military becomes very complicated. So one of the things that Jews are supposed to observe is the Sabbath. And you're not supposed to do work on the Sabbath. So if you're a soldier, that's kind of impossible to maintain, right? Which doesn't mean that some Jews did not do it. Some Jews did become soldiers, but oftentimes Jews would be excused from military service because they could not fulfill their obligation of being available on any day to work. So that was one reason that Jews might not engage in Roman military life. And then same thing for Christ believers, depending on what they were doing to observe the Lord's Day and what that meant in various Christ-believing communities, participating in the military might be problematic, just very practically speaking. The food was also another issue. Most food that you could buy in the ancient world, if you went to the marketplace, to the Greek agora or to the Roman region, you were buying food that had been sacrificed to Greek or Roman gods. The meat had been sacrificed, the animal was ritually slaughtered, and then that meat was sold in the market. So this is when Paul in Corinthians talks about meat at the table of idols. That's what he's talking about. Any meat that you would buy probably had been ritually slain and sacrificed to an idol from a Jewish or Christian perspective. So what about your military rations, right? We also have images from the ancient world that show us, this is a fairly well-preserved fresco from a city called Dura Europus, which is near Palmyra in Syria. But this shows soldiers, and you can see that the larger man in the center there is making an incense sacrifice. So part of military life was to sacrifice to the Roman gods who were meant to protect you and protect the empire, right? Why do we sacrifice the Capitoline Triad, Jupiter, Minerva, and Juno? Because those gods are responsible for the safety of the empire. So if you're a soldier committing yourself to the protection of that empire, it makes sense that you would want to align yourself with those gods who are also protecting your people. So for Jews and Christians, the idea of your regular military operations, including sacrifice, would be problematic, right? Because you are not supposed to sacrifice to gods who are not the God of Israel. The interesting thing about this fresco is that it appears in Dura Europus, which is a city where we know there was a large Jewish population. And so it's possible that this fresco actually shows Jewish soldiers performing the sacrifice, maybe to their God for the safety of the Roman Empire. That was the thing that happened, but maybe to the Capitoline Triad. So it's a more complicated question than whether they would have or wouldn't have. It's not a cut and dry answer for how Jews or Christians would have engaged with the military.
There's that story about that the soldier who has a servant and entreats Jesus to come and heal him. And Jesus says he's a man of faith.
Yes.
And he declares him faithful and just get your faith.
Yeah, and that's going to be the final passage that I have in the PowerPoint, just looking ahead, just to think about ways in which that image of soldier is very complicated. Okay, I have one more image for you, let me pull out my notes here and make sure I'm not missing anything. Military life, okay, we'll stick with this one for a second. Military life, you can see the army massed here. I think that nicely represents the sort of shared goal that soldiers would have, right? They are a military company, became very close because they are in the trenches together, right? That shared goal sometimes could mean shared religious expression. So adding to this complication about whether you're worshiping the Roman gods is another god and cult who we know was very, very popular among Roman soldiers throughout the empire. And this cult sort of came from the eastern side of the empire, Mithras. And this guy, Mithras, you see shown here sort of fighting with a bull, was the focus of a cult that thought about resurrection. And this was a cult that was very popular among soldiers for reasons that might make good sense to us, right? If you're constantly in danger of being killed as part of your job, perhaps you are interested in a god or a demigod who could protect you and could resurrect you. So there was a proliferation of shrines for Mithras in the military colonies. And this is at the same time as early Christianity is happening, where a lot of the focus is on resurrection. So there's sort of this competing religious cult that was very popular among soldiers.
Like the Viking Valhalla?
A little bit, yeah. Yeah, that there is this promise that even if you die, there is something beyond that that is not just the underworld, where mostly the underworld is just a place where people go to hang out. Nothing special happens. There are special spots for people who have distinguished themselves, but there's not really a reward, right? So if you are aligned with Mithras and he is protecting you, when you die, what you might experience would be much more positive, right? And this was very popular among soldiers. Yes?
For that cult, isn't that the cult that initiation took place and you were showered with blood?
That's a torobolium, which is a kind of sacrifice, so it's not typical for the Mithras cult.
Not Mithras, okay.
Yeah, but that was something that could happen just in Roman society. But that was a very expensive sacrifice, right? Okay. To sacrifice a bull is a much bigger deal than to sacrifice, say, a sheep or a bird. So you're probably pretty wealthy if you were doing that. No, this is a cult that involves initiation, and there are certain rituals that you would go through and you would learn secrets or mysteries. And once you had been initiated into those mysteries, you would be part of the cult. But soldiers throughout the empire, we know, were very interested in this religious cult. So that's a little bit about who soldiers were and what their duties were and how they were sort of fit into the empire. Yeah, please.
And the hierarchy among soldiers?
They had ranks. There were military ranks.
Drawn from the lower classes for the most part.
Yes.
The commanders were people who rose in those ranks, or were they people from...
That is a great question. It's both. So how did they get military commanders, right? So sometimes it was people who rose through the ranks. Sometimes it was people who were from wealthy families, usually a second son or third son, who would go into military service as a way to make their name, and you would get officers from both of those sources. So there's some really interesting stories about popular military commanders who had come from the lower classes and the elites who were sort of feeling threatened by the rise of these lower class military leaders. The emperor himself was seen as the supreme commander of the military, which is why you often find statues of the emperor who may or may not have done real military service, but dressed in military garb to sort of represent his command of those imperial forces and the authority that gives him.
Were you in the military for life? Or could you leave whenever you wanted to?
You usually did not serve through your whole life. There was sort of a retirement that would happen. You generally did not leave military service voluntarily. Yes.
Did you have a wife and children, or were you?
While you were serving, many people did not have a wife and children. A lot of times soldiers would wait to marry until they had received their land and property and were out in the provinces, and then they would start a family, because they then had wealth to sustain that. Yes.
Yesterday we talked about the athletes and how it wasn't necessarily, they weren't respected necessarily. They
yes.
Kind of, so was it an honorable thing for your son to go and be a soldier?
Yes, that was more respected. More and respected. So we talked about in the ancient Greek world that a lot of the athletic training was sort of geared towards military service.
Right.
In the Roman Empire, that consistent athletic training had kind of stopped. Some Greek cities maintained it, but soldiering was still a path of upward mobility for lower classes, and so that was a respected thing, especially because we have letters that show us when somebody became a soldier. We've got letters from Egypt, for example. So a native Egyptian becomes a soldier, a Roman soldier, and then gets a Roman name. So he tells his family, send your letters to this outpost, write to me as Marcus whatever. So he gets a new name, which is a mark of his citizenship. So this is an extreme sort of advancement, and he can send money back to his family.
Hmm. So then that doesn't sound like an oppressor. You know, like if a family, you know what I mean? Like if their children are becoming soldiers in the Roman Empire, that's not an oppressor. That's giving them a step forward.
Well, it's a really interesting, so a lot of post-colonial studies tell us like, okay, so in what ways do people who have been oppressed become participants, reluctant or happy in the systems that have been put in place to oppress them, right? So it is, people might have had very mixed feelings or very different ideas about what it means to be part of this military.
I'm just saying, we can think about like what happens on the subcontinent under the British, where there's many Indian members of the British military working in, and then nevertheless, this is perceived as, because you get ahead that way, but it doesn't necessarily, or think about tax collectors in the Roman Empire, in Judah, and how they're thought about in the New Testament, right? So it's not, just because people are participating doesn't necessarily mean it's not
they want to, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of the texts that we have that preserve stories about, oh, this person became part of the military in advance, are written from the perspective of someone who is an elite in the Roman Empire, and so would say, well, isn't this great that people have decided to join our ranks? So we don't necessarily have the voices preserved of people who experienced this as oppression. One place that we do see opposition to the Roman Empire and the Roman military is in the New Testament. Some of these texts, the interesting story from Mark's gospel about the Gerasene demoniac, who the demon is named Legion, right, and is sent out into a flock of pigs who run off a cliff. I mean, that's a pretty clear jab against Roman imperial forces. And then the book of Revelation is another place where we really see this system that the empire has put in place is awfully bad, right? It's being associated with Babylon, and I think that makes very good sense if we go back to this image. Jacob, I think you were going to talk in your session yesterday about the Babylonian exile. So in 579, 578 BCE, Babylonian Empire came over and destroyed the temple in Jerusalem and sent Jews out from their homeland. In 70 CE, the Roman imperial forces came and destroyed the temple in Jerusalem. And so when you read Babylon in the book of Revelation, it's code for Rome, because you don't want to say Rome is really awful because they might come kill you, right? This is only 20 years after this happened. But you can say Babylon and people know what you mean, right? Yes?
I just would comment, use the image of British colonialism, and but we need to kind of also understand our American history of using Native people to be a part of our military.
Yes, thank you.
We sought, you know, participation there for various reasons, but also were oppressive in their participation.
Oppressions who escaped, came to this country in order to avoid being conscripted in the army, ended up in the cavalry.
And the military is still a path to citizenship for many people in the United States today, right?
So the war.
Our way, ROTC, a way out for people in poverty.
Yes. Right. So this is a very nice transition into where we're going, which is contemporary case studies. So some of these things to consider, right? Our own American history of colonial activity. The links between military service and various kinds of rewards that are valuable to people. The military is a path to socioeconomic advancement. I'm going to go ahead and skip this passage for now, and we'll come back, because I do want to talk about soldiers today. So I have a bunch of statistics that I found from the Department of Veterans Affairs, and so this is their 2019 most updated information on their website. One of the major concerns that we know about for military veterans and for active duty military today is PTSD, right, post-traumatic stress disorder. We have some statistics, and the number of veterans with PTSD varies by service era. So we're sort of seeing, I think this is both about diagnosis and about people's military experience, right? This is a condition that we are more aware of today than we have been in the past. Operations Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom, about 11 to 20% have PTSD in a given year. From the Gulf War, Operation Desert Storm, probably about 12% of those veterans have PTSD in a given year. From the Vietnam War, this one's interesting, so I'll just go ahead and read it. About 15 out of every 100 Vietnam veterans were currently diagnosed with PTSD at the time of the most recent study in the late 1980s. The National Vietnam Veterans Readjustment Study, that's what it was, but it's estimated that about 30 out of every 100 of Vietnam veterans have had PTSD in their lifetime. Other factors in a combat situation can add more stress to an already stressful situation. This may contribute to PTSD and other mental health problems. These factors include what you do in the war, the politics around the war, where the war is fought, and the type of enemy you face. Another cause of PTSD in the military can be military sexual trauma. This is any sexual harassment or sexual assault that occurs while you're in the military. It can happen to both men and women and can occur during peacetime, training, or war. Among veterans who use VA healthcare, right? So again, this is a not a full representation of the population, but among veterans who use VA healthcare, about 23% of women reported sexual assault when in the military. 55% of women and 38% of men have experienced sexual harassment when in the military. And again, those numbers are from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs website this year. So PTSD, I think, is a major consideration that we are aware of today that I think people were aware of in the ancient world, but we're not talking about in the same way. I think if we read some of the texts about soldiers who are at war and coming back from war, including the Iliad and the Odyssey, we can see something that might look to us like PTSD, but they were not talking about that as a cost of military service in the same way that we do. I also wanted to mention specifically the concept of moral injury, and in that short paragraph I read, this says different factors can add more stress to an already stressful situation, right? What are you doing in the war? What are the politics around the war? And what's the relationship between your own moral conscience and what you're being asked to do, right? So this is a concept called moral injury, where it's not just physical injury that happens or mental stress. There's also the possibility that you have performed some action in the course of war that violates your own ethical code or your moral conscience, and that that is as deep and lasting a wound as any kind of physical wound. And this is something that a lot of scholars of trauma, of the military, of biblical studies and ethics are talking about right now, which I think is a really helpful thing to think with. So I wanted to share one example with you. So this is a person that I met and did not know well, because while I was at the University of Chicago doing my graduate work, he was also a graduate student there in the Divinity School. His name is Joshua Castile, and some of you may have heard of him. He and his family published a book called Letters from Abu Ghraib, because Josh was a soldier who was trained as an interrogator and went to Abu Ghraib to do interrogations. Now, he arrived there after some of the news about interrogations and torture had already come out, so there were more restrictions and more oversight happening at the time that he was doing his work. So he did not cross some of those lines that we see as basic human rights violation lines. But the book, Letters from Abu Ghraib, records his experience and the letters that, or the emails that he sent to his family and friends, sort of as he's thinking through what it means to be an interrogator and to think of other human beings as your enemies. So he was very good. He was rewarded for his service because he was an excellent interrogator, but he had a lot of internal turmoil about what it means to sit across from someone and to have commanders who are instructing you to get the information from this evil person. And when he's in conversation with the person, he actually found and uses this language, one way to get people to talk to you is to be compassionate and to act as a confessor, because people don't want to carry around the weight of the deeds that they have committed. And so he was meeting people face to face as human beings with dignity, but in a context where he was being expected to think of them as less than human. And this conflict became too much for him. He eventually applied for conscientious objector status and received that status, and then came back to the States became a speaker, did a lot of peace work with a group out of Notre Dame, and then published this book that sort of chronicles his journey and his struggle with moral injury, what he was being commanded to do, not fitting with his understanding of his call as a Christian person.
Because he was having them confess, and then he'd betray them. I mean, essentially is how
he was using the information that he was given the information that he was given, he reported to his superiors, and it was used in operations, some of which resulted in unintended deaths of civilians, right? So that was part of it. I think his bigger problem from the letters appears to have been his direct engagement with that person. So he's being told, go in and talk to that dog, and then he sits in front of the person and realizes this Muslim and I, a Christian, have a lot more in common and are able to meet each other as equals, and yet my commanders are thinking of them as less than human, right? So that's one example of moral injury. There are many others that we could talk about, including where people have been responsible for the deaths of civilians and then struggle with that, right? Because I went into the military to do a particular kind of thing, which was to put it very simply, like fight the bad guys, and then I ended up killing innocent people. I have a lot of conflict there, yes.
But this was even presented in MASH, the MASH episode.
Yeah.
Where a gentleman, they figured out that he just couldn't handle it anymore. Called himself Jesus Christ. And some people thought that was offensive, you know, I mean, people within the compound there, but that's what they finally figured out, is that all the different killing of people who he didn't know, he could not morally do this,
mm-hmm.
and that his brain then went into that mode.
Mm-hmm. Right, this could be a big, if we're thinking about cognitive dissonance, that's a phrase that has come up earlier in the week. How do you be a Christian person and be a soldier? Many people do it, right? This is not, I'm not suggesting that it's not possible. And there are many conversations about what we mean by just war. But it's really interesting for us today to think of this metaphor of soldiers of Christ. And there's a lot more complicated stuff that we bring to it than what Paul was bringing to it. So my question for you is this useful as a metaphor for belonging to the Christian community?
I was saying there are other injuries in war.
Yes.
That occur. I have three cousins who died, none of them in battle. One was a test pilot in World War II. One was at White Sands. And one died of lung cancer from Agent Orange.
Yes, yes. So. And Joshua did die very young of cancer that they believe was associated with his military service. Yes.
So the results of war are legion.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And this is not even getting into the costs for military families, right, and loved ones who are also participating in that service in various ways. Yeah.
Also, perhaps differences between regular army reserves or citizen soldiers and yes. mercenaries.
Yes.
So a mercenary, I mean, it's all about money and perhaps advancement, but it's not, I think, it's altruistic as a citizen soldier.
I'm thinking even about situations with ICE right now and the moral injury of separating families. You can't expect that the people that are serving or working or whatever verb you use are not at risk of severe moral injury.
Yep. Yeah. How do police and jobs like that mesh with military?
Right. I think that the extreme militarization of police in the United States is an important consideration for us, and how that plays into this question, right? If police are meant to be peace officers, that is a very different thing from the sort of militarized forces that we sometimes see. Yes.
We live on Whidbey Island, right underneath the outfield where they're doing touch and goes. And this week they're supposed to be flying from 8 o'clock in the morning till 12 o'clock at night, over and over and over again, touching down. We kind of think of the Navy as the enemy where we live. And my sister and her husband are both career Air Force. And I hear it from Navy personnel, you know, that we try to say, don't do this to us, you know. Sort of use the word citizen as a bad word. Civilian is a bad word.
Sure.
Which...
But I appreciate bringing up the term career soldiers, right? What does that mean to have a military career? Is that the same as to be a soldier in the ancient world? Or do we need something much more all-encompassing with that?
There's a set of policies, rules of engagement,
yes.
All that, and everybody
yes.
has to work by those things. And I wonder, do the ancient soldiers have those sorts of rules of engagement? One of the things that strikes me about our modern warfare is that those engagement rules are very sophisticated, very complex, and morally very complex.
Yes.
And the decisions that soldiers, even the privates, the lowest ranking ones, have to make in any particular situation are pretty morally complex, that seems to me.
And that there is a whole military justice system, right, that is designed to put a check on extreme behavior or immoral behavior. I don't think that in the ancient world there were certainly not as sophisticated or complex moral codes for the military. Yes.
There were some rules, I think, that come up. Even John the Baptist told, what should we do? And be content with your pay and don't make somebody go, you know. And as I understand it, the soldier could be carrying his bag and he could just tap somebody with his spear and they were forced to carry, you know, his luggage. Mm-hmm. And then they had rules that you could only go so far. I mean, it seems to me that was...
Yeah, there were certainly ethical guidelines, right? And if we think back to the athletic training and the importance of virtue in the ancient world that's associated with the ascesis and discipline, soldiers were expected to uphold a sort of, not a chivalric code, right? But the ancient equivalent of that, a sort of moral ethical code. But it certainly was not codified in the way that it is today. Yeah.
I'm sitting here, my own personal testimony is I'm in conflict here because my father, you know, left his past behind and the military gave him a step into his future.
Absolutely.
And I would not be here today if it wasn't for that, But at the same time, I was always in conflict when, in some of my faith formation, when we talk about spiritual warfare, you know, there mm-hmm. that was part of my faith formation, and I just resisted that because I never associated being a Christian with being violent, and warfare for me, you know, I didn't live through Vietnam, but I studied Vietnam, and I sit there, and it just doesn't sit well with me, and so I feel like I'm in such conflict right now because my dad being a soldier was what brought me, I feel like, to this place,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time, I resist this warfare language or being, mm-hmm. you know, at camps, you know, growing up, like we'd sing, I am a wounded soldier and I will, you know, give up the fight or whatever. And I'm just sitting here going, that doesn't resonate with me. And so it's just, I feel the conflict, I feel like that we're in right now with how do we associate ourselves as soldiers for Jesus?
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's interesting to me to think about. So, who is directly touched by military service and who is not, and are the attitudes different, right? Does that metaphor of soldier, I assume it must, work differently for people who have been soldiers, right? Who have done military service. So there might be various voices in the room or in our Christian communities where, yeah, soldier works for me as a metaphor of belonging because literally being a soldier means belonging in a particular way, and so I can think about my belonging in the church in that way as well. And for others, it may be associated solely with violence, or it may be associated primarily with oppression, in which case that's not going to be a helpful metaphor, right? But all of those voices are part of our church, so how do we deal with this image being there prominently in the New Testament?
Yeah, that actually leads into a thing I've been thinking about, which is how we make the canons, how we form canons within canon, mm-hmm. and then how those become sort of self-determining in certain ways. So certain kinds of Christians seem to be more likely to use martial metaphors.
Sure.
I am fairly committed to not being one of those kinds of Christians for reasons not related to martial metaphors.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, so for example, oftentimes these metaphors are used by Christians who I see to be doing a kind of toxic masculinity as, you know, sort of muscular Christianity or whatever those mm-hmm. whatever those things are.
Yeah.
The men's Bible, whatever
yeah.
whatever
the yeah, yeah, yeah.
And because I am committed to not doing those things that I see to be harmful, using these metaphors would seem to be putting me in a camp with people I find fairly repugnant Christians, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that they have other versions of that.
Right, and there are other people who use it for other reasons, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So part of what I'm curious about is how we think about the metaphors as a kind of self-naming as the kind of Christian that I am. Which of these scriptural metaphors I'm more likely to use?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that it should be open, and part of what I hope is coming out of the discussion this week is that some of these are going to resonate with you and some of them are not. And if that is real, then that is real for other people in the community. And so it's really worth being mindful of the fact that sometimes you're going to pull one of these metaphors out and it's going to shut people down, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to make them not feel like they belong. Yes, and then
One of the things that we can do if we're in charge of worship or have anything to do with it is to examine the hymns that we sing.
Yes.
I was on the Methodist Hymnal Revision Committee, and when we said we were taking 200 Christian soldiers out of the hymnal, we had 12,000 letters saying leave it in. Well, we did, but we also put another hymn into that tune, and people seemed pretty mollified.
Oh, okay.
But the Onward Christian Soldiers appears in background of war movies.
Mm-hmm.
It was written as a children's marching song from one classroom or the church sanctuary to another.
Yeah.
You know, march like soldiers going, in other words, be orderly. And if you look at the background of a lot of hymns, you find things that you don't realize you're singing, like stand up for Jesus, you soldiers of the cross,
mm-hmm.
which may seem to some people you're supposed to bash people who don't like Jesus.
Sure.
That's, you know, that's not what is intended. Or the hymn Faith of Our Fathers, people say, oh, that's about Abraham and Jacob and stuff like that. It's not. It was written about the Roman Catholic priests in England who were martyred under Protestant rule. And they're the ones that went into the dungeons and the chains. So I just think it's important for us to look at what we're singing, because we take it in.
Yeah.
And we sing it. We really do. And
that, I think, can affect us more insidiously or just more subtly than what we're reading in the scripture. Because I think a lot of times what you read in the lectionary gets discussed in a homily, mm-hmm. and so it's contextualized, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what you sing maybe just goes through and somebody hears it. And so I saw your hand here.
Well, actually, I was also going to talk about hymns.
Yes.
Because that's exactly right. That, because somehow music gets into you in ways that mm-hmm. words don't necessarily do mm-hmm. by themselves. And so that is a word of, I've noticed that we have changed in my congregation, deliberately eased off of some of the hymnody that we used to sing a
sure.
lot. Because it becomes caustic for some people.
Yeah, and not for everybody, right? But
right.
for some people, yes. Okay, I want to stop us, unfortunately, because it is 10. Just to show you, I did have the passage here from the gospel. Most of the passages I've been using are from the letters, because that's where most of the metaphors show up. But there is the passage where Jesus engages with the soldier, Matthew 8. And then I did have a passage here from Philippians 2, where Paul refers to Epaphroditus as his fellow soldier and talks about what it means to be a soldier. So thank you for the discussion today. I think this was really great. I'm excited to talk about the image body of Christ tomorrow, which I think is super complicated. So I hope you will be back and help us all think through it. Thank you so much.
Yeah.